Before coming into politics, I was a physiotherapist working in the NHS, just with a real passion and burden to see improvement in our community.
You're listening to Humans of Politics, a podcast about how it feels to be a politician. My name is A.B. Philbin Bowman, and my guest today is the British Labour MP, Rachel Maskell.
As a result of that, I had a great opportunity to be able to stand for Parliament and to try and bring about change into our country, but also into my city of York.
Just in terms of your daily work, because at some level, you know, you're helping people in both of those jobs, but what's the emotional difference in the way you're helping people before and the way you're helping people now?
Well, there's so many comparisons, you know, and it's often quite hard to say that there are differences, because I met physical need, I guess, as a physio, but now people come with all sorts of problems to me and I sit there and will battle through to find the right solutions to help them. So I would say, as a kind of public servant, there's very little that distinguishes maybe a politician from the day-to-day work of anybody working across the public sector.
In terms of the work environment, in terms of how easy or difficult the system is to work with, how do those compare?
Well, Parliament itself is a completely alien environment to anything that I've experienced before, and certainly I don't feel comfortable here, and I hopefully, you know, if the day I ever did feel comfortable, that would be the day to leave, because I think, you know, it is a very different culture here. It's very conditioning, and I find myself railing against that, because I'm just an ordinary person here with a passion to improve things for my community. So I try and put the systems aside and find ways of finding those resolutions. Often it's quite challenging. We have debates, they're often unanswered. We ask questions again, no answers forthcoming. And even select committees produce fantastic reports and often they don't get through. So I find trying to have constructive meetings with colleagues across the House, but also with ministers, as a way of trying to find resolution to many of the challenges people in York face.
It's interesting you mentioned it being an alien environment, and the architecture is extraordinary and very particular. And somebody made the point once that this looks like Eton. It looks like all these really old establishments in England. So if you went to those places, you come in here and you go, oh, I feel right at home. But if you didn't, you go, this place is completely alien. Do you think that has some kind of psychological effect or an alienating effect on people, that just the physical, what this place looks like and is like to be in?
This is what I mean by the kind of conditioning of the place and people opening doors for you and things like that. So I do think some people are very much more attuned to the culture. I see it as a museum. Ultimately, it's a workspace, and it's a strange place, Parliament, because you get the public coming in and lobbying, you get school children coming on trips, and you're also trying to get meetings done and to use it as a space for debate and for trying to further what's happening in the country. Where I think my biggest disappointment is the lack of politics in Parliament, because I think we're trying to advance the needs of our society at this time, and yet everything is so tribal and charged. And I think actually things aren't in the black and white space, they're very much more in the grey space in the real world. And as you kind of work through to try and find solutions, it's very unhelpful when everything is just closed on a vote, yes or no, as opposed to let's tweak and change and adjust. And that's why I think processes which were adopted, and it seems to be less so now, things like pre-legislative procedures. So instead of just talking through the legislation as is and trying to amend through putting down certain amendments, a pre-legislative process was very much about the dialogue of the issues. How do we use the evidence to best resolve that? And obviously bring in experts and voices to help inform that process. So I think things could improve about the way this place works.
And you're an MP who on a number of issues has, as you said, grey spaces and not being tribal. You're somebody who has on occasion gone, my party is saying it's going this way, but I actually believe something else. What's it like to do that? How does it feel, I guess, to be an MP in the Houses of Parliament, voting in a way where the people who sit around you and the people who you generally agree with and generally like and get on with in your party take a different view? And just emotionally, what's that like?
Well, I guess it depends on the issue, but ultimately I'm here as a representative of my community, and it's really important to do that. But also I'm here as a person, and I'm not here to compromise what I believe is to be the right way forward on issues. So I think you have to work through an agenda and to discern when those times are where you have to take a stand. And I wouldn't say I'm a persistent rebel, but one thing is really important is that if you believe that something is moving in the right direction, is that you're able to work through your arguments as to why, but then also to vote and to have that say as well. Because we live in a complex society, don't we, where people have such a range of views and opinions and evidence. And if this place can't reflect that, then something's very bad with the system.
What was it like being a woman in Labour saying, I'm pro-life, that's my position and I want to... What was this at a personal level? What kind of response did that engender from your fellow MPs?
Obviously, sometimes in politics you're in lonely spaces, and I think if you're confident in the decisions you're making and the reason for that, and of course there's much time for reflection as well. And I think particularly if we look at the issue of abortion and recognise the sensitivities around that. And of course, for my belief, it's like the woman in the situation as well as the neonatal, the prenatal life. I think both are really precious lives. And therefore, my kind of concern very much comes through is that we're seeing over 200,000 abortions in England and Wales every year. That's to me a public health emergency, and yet nobody's addressing the reasons for that and how we address that particular issue. And I don't think we can just march forward on issues without drawing breath and saying, hang on a moment, what is really going on? Why have we got this situation with some of the highest rates of abortion across the world here in the UK? So I tend to be a politician that does a lot of questioning and thinking through issues, but also saying, well, are we really questioning the value of every single life in this? And to me, a prenatal life is still a life. And having worked in the NHS, you know, I had the privilege of working with neonates at 22 weeks. Fragile little life, and it makes you reflect obviously what that life actually means, and to the parents, and as well as for the future richness of our country. And I'm don't deny these really difficult, sensitive issues, and I think they must be approached as such.
And as you say, it's a time of enormous division right across Britain and indeed within the Labour Party. And again, I'm just wondering, like, you come into politics with a particular outlook, a particular way of wanting to do things and a particular idea of who the opposition is and who are and what you believe. How frustrating or otherwise is it to spend time arguing with people who on a lot of things you agree with within your own party, but who you have certain clear disagreements with?
Well, we're all different, and that's kind of the richness of our kind of a community, isn't it? Is that we all have different information and different formed opinions, and therefore I think debate sharpens us and can sharpen the environment. So I think it's healthy to have robust debate. I don't think there's anything negative about that. And clearly, I think if we were in a party which believed all the things we did, we'd be on our own. We'd all set up our own parties, wouldn't we? So political parties are coalitions of people which have a broad sense of value, purpose and direction. And sometimes there'll be people in opposite parties that you have probably more in common with on issues than within your own party. And I think there's got to be recognition that tribalism shouldn't dominate in the way that it often does in politics.
Another issue that I know you're extremely passionate about is the whole environmental climate change piece. And I mean, just looking at the science of that, it almost seems hopeless. You can read it and go, well, we have to get to, according to the science, versus what people are prepared to do and change in their own lives. There seems to be such a chasm between that. How do you maintain optimism? How do you process all of that pretty grim reading?
I think frustration is timescales, really. We don't have time to mess around on this. And when the government talk about 2050 as a time of being net zero carbon, I just think this is way, way, way too late. And we've got to really accelerate the programme of change. And of course, politics is about doing the possible. And often I feel there's this slow pace that people are not ambitious enough at trying to really drive change. And we've got wake-up calls now. My city floods, I know the consequences of climate change, and as a result of that we've got to seek a way of finding justice. And therefore, whatever the issue, the thing that frustrates me more as a politician than anything else is when you know what the right answer is, and it's almost like everybody in the room tacitly knows, but then different decisions are made. And I just think we've got to be more ambitious, more honest, and very much set out that agenda. So giving an example, in my city, loads of luxury flats and houses are being built. Yeah, I've got a social housing need, which is desperate. People are homeless, people in real deficit. And yet, you know, decision makers can make alternative choices, but that just isn't happening. And that's very frustrating.
Completely different question. What do you do to unwind?
Oh, my goodness. I think at the moment where there's kind of Brexit fever is that it's very hard to detach yourself. But I do enjoy going out into the fresh air and countryside, walking, cycling, and just kind of restoring myself. And I think nature is a really great place to do that.
You mentioned Brexit fever. It is a bit unavoidable. You were first elected in 2015 to Parliament. So what was the atmosphere in Parliament like before Brexit versus after the Brexit? What's the difference been for you?
Well, Brexit came on the agenda very quickly because one of the first pieces of legislation under Cameron's government was to put forward the legislation around a referendum. So it's kind of been on that journey the whole way with me. Clearly, a year after being elected, seeing a referendum, there was the tragedy that hit with the murder of Jill Cox, and I think it shook us all. And we haven't gone back. As a result of that, it's very much marked our time here as politicians, and rightly so. But I think the thing that has concerned me and growing me in my time in Parliament is seeing this rise of the far right, and seeing it getting a foothold and confidence across our political system, which just a short time ago was unimaginable. And I think what we've seen globally, whether it's in, of course, kind of Bolsonaro in Brazil, or Modi in India, or Trump, or Le Pen, and whilst not elected, thankfully, yet, or indeed the politics we've got in the United Kingdom at the moment, how quickly things can change into a very negative space. And this whole change around populist politics, so no longer, and the way that I often put it is that we have the academic argument, that just doesn't cut through. It's the one-liner. And if you repeat the lie, that even if it's, you know it not to be true, it still cuts through. And I think we've got to really address how we do our politics in this age of populism. And I see that as a real challenge to the way that we conduct ourselves, but also the way that we debate. And of course, very conscious that the inequality driven across our communities has meant that many people have been out of the political debate for some time, and we have got to have not only resources and make reparation around our public services and our social fabric, but also where power sits and how do we see equality of power moving forward.
Two more questions. One is, can you name me a politician with whom you disagree on Brexit but who you like and respect at a personal level?
Gosh, that's incredibly challenging. There are so many, and I think even some of the politicians within the Labour Party, I look at my good comrade Graham Morris, and he represents a constituency where his constituents voted to leave, and he very much and earnestly wants to ensure that their voices are heard in Westminster. However, we're both strong trade unionists, and we understand, you know, the importance it is to find the right solutions to many of the challenges our communities have faced really since kind of the change in the national consensus under Thatcherism and the breakdown of society resulting from that. So we have things in common, but we're approaching them in different ways.
And finally then, I'd like to live in a world where politicians are sufficiently well-informed and well-rested to make good decisions. In the same way you want a surgeon to make good decisions, you want a pilot to make good decisions, we mandate how many hours a pilot can and cannot fly, because at the critical moment you want them to be well-rested and very good at their job. What do you think we could change about the job of politicians, or the way we've set up politicians to work, that would give them the space and time to actually rest, reflect? What supports could we put in place for politicians that aren't there at the moment?
I think it's crucial that politicians have thinking space. It is a 24/7 culture, and if we did more thinking and looked at things in depth, we'd be able to get further upstream to make the changes. And I think often I see decisions here which are about sticking plasters over problems as opposed to really getting into causation and why things happen. Just regulating the working week would be one way of really kind of looking at how we can create more space for proper in-depth debate in Parliament. There's two debating chambers. There's the main chamber, which most people would see, say, that's used at Prime Minister's Question Time, but Westminster Hall tends to be a more thoughtful space where people do their research and debate very important topics. So creating more space for debate and not necessarily seeing this as a divisive debate, but people more sitting around the table. And even the shape of that second debating chamber in Westminster Hall, it's in an arc, not in two confronting lines of benches. And I think that says a lot about the quality of debate over there compared to often we see in the chamber.
Thanks for listening to Humans of Politics Season 2. There'll be more from Westminster next week. If anything got you angry or got you thinking, all feedback is welcome. I am on Twitter as AB Philbin Bowman, at ABIEPB. Finally, you've probably noticed that we are living through a time when democracy itself is under attack and where political debate has become angry, distrustful, and hyper-partisan. And I'm not suggesting that we can single-handedly reverse that with podcasts, but if you think that conversations like this are a step in the right direction and you'd like more people to discover it, the easiest and cheapest thing you could do would be to leave us a nice review wherever you listen. Thanks again.